Some of you haven't heard it. Some of you heard it once. Others twice. And I think Sister Esther three times. But we present it differently on most occasions. So we hope that those that have heard it in the past will get some added blessing. My favorite theme text that usually I write in the manner is John 6:44. No man can come to me except the Father which hath sent me draw him, and I will raise him up at the last day. In 1 John 4:19, the Apostle John expresses our thoughts when he says, we love him because he first loved us. We did not know Christ first. He first knew us. This is the theme or tenor of the remarks we'd like to make today. First, in the Gospel of John, in the first chapter, verse 44. Now Philip was of Bethsaida, the city of Andrew and Peter. Philip findeth Nathanael, and saith unto him, we have found him of whom Moses in the law and the prophets did write, Jesus of Nazareth, the son of Joseph. And Nathanael said unto him, can there any good thing come out of Nazareth? Philip saith unto him, come and see. Jesus saw Nathanael coming to him. Now, Philip and Nathanael are approaching Jesus, but they're at a distance. And Jesus evidently is conversing with other people from the context. Jesus saw Nathanael coming to him and saith of him, behold an Israelite indeed, in whom there is no guile. Nathanael saith unto him, whence knowest thou me? Jesus answered and said unto him, before that Philip called thee, when thou wast under the fig tree, I saw thee. Evidently, Nathanael previously had heard about Jesus of Nazareth. His reputation spread rather rapidly, and he was questioning whether it could be possible that Jesus might have been the promised one, particularly from the fact that as far as the public were aware, they thought Jesus was born in Nazareth, since he spent the greater part of his youth and the early part of his manhood in that vicinity, not aware of the fact that it was when Joseph and Mary went down to Bethlehem to be taxed because of the decree by Augustus Caesar, that it was there that the child was born, and then later went to Egypt, returned from Egypt, and settled in Nazareth. So to all purposes, the public would think that he was a citizen of Nazareth, a very lowly, disesteemed town. So while we feel that we are conjecturalizing, but we think properly that Nathanael, in questioning this matter of the possibility of Jesus being the Messiah, would find it very difficult to reconcile the fact that he arose from Nazareth. So he takes this matter to God in prayer, beseeching wisdom. In the meantime, while he's there, under the shelter and the privacy of the fig tree, like his closet, as it were, of prayer, Philip is calling to him, Nathanael! Nathanael! And he hears, and it interrupts him, and
He wonders what this is all about.
We have found him, of whom Moses in the law did say.
So forth.
And then he questions Jesus of Nazareth. And then he says, can any good thing come out of Nazareth? This is the very thing that was perplexing him.
So now, Philip said, as we read before, come and see. Come see for yourself. So he comes, and here the two of them now are approaching Jesus. And Jesus says of him, that is to others who are nearby, behold an Israelite indeed in whom there's no guile. Now, there's a basis for these remarks. How did Jesus know that Nathanael was under that fig tree? Notice what he says. He doesn't say that you were under the fig tree, but that I saw you there. In other words, this is a method that God used with regard to Jesus. It's the Father that draws. By Jesus, the call is made. The Father illuminates Jesus' mind. We have this, was it telekinesis or something like that, sort of like an ESP arrangement, where Jesus evidently, when Philip approached Nathanael, he saw Nathanael under the tree, actually had a vision, heard a little of this conversation, and being that Jesus knew what was in man, could size up Nathanael very quickly, the temperament he had. And he couldn't keep in his heart what was on his mind. He had to blurt it out to Philip, can any good thing come out of Nazareth? This is his nature that was troubling him. So Jesus, seeing him under the tree, hearing his remarks, could size him up as being one that's not with guile. There are people who keep hidden their thoughts. There are others, they just have to let it be known, honestly, openly, what is troubling them, even though it may, to a certain extent, seem to demean them in the eyes of others. And knowing this nature and what was troubling him, and that he was not guileless, he was not one to keep secrets hidden in his breast, but came out with Philip to tell what was troubling him, that this was an indicator of his character and disposition, so that Jesus could say, not just mechanically, behold an Israelite indeed in whom is no guile, but in this pictorial display and audio visual of the reality, could surmise the situation so that he could speak with intonation and conviction to Nathanael as he was approaching an Israelite. Indeed, he did know Nathanael. And then, of course, this convinced Nathanael, this man, this is miraculous. Well, it would be miraculous, true, that this vision that would be supplied to Jesus was miraculous, but we believe it was directed of the Father, that the Father chose Nathanael, drew him through the means of Philip to Jesus. And then, meeting Jesus, he prostrated himself and accepted him as indeed the one promised and sent of God. Then we find that Nathanael saith unto him, whence knowest thou me? Jesus answered and said unto him, before that Philip called thee, when thou wast under the fig tree, I saw thee. Very interesting. You know, we lose so much by racing today. We do not think. Another thing, when Nathanael was approaching and Jesus addressed him, that behold an Israelite indeed in whom is no guile, he thought maybe this man is a preposterer, that he was intimating to others that he knew Nathanael. You know, pull a bluff. This is pulling a bluff that he knew him. So this technique was used to address Nathanael, to convince him personally, Nathanael, that Jesus was not an impostor, even though he still did not know but that he was of Nazareth. At this moment, he had enough conviction. Now, Nathanael answered and said unto him, Rabbi, thou art the Son of God. Thou art the King of Israel. You can see his hopes were pent up in that respect, that he was looking for that promised one. Jesus answered, said to him, because I said unto thee, I saw thee under the fig tree, believest thou? Thou shalt see greater things than these. Verily, verily, I say unto you, hereafter ye shall see heaven open, and the angels of God ascending and descending before the Son of Man, not upon. He's saying that the experience that Nathanael had convinced him of Jesus' messiahship, and it was a personal, unique relationship. But Jesus is saying the time is coming when this unique experience will be performed with regard to humanity in the kingdom. There'll be millions praying at different times, and their prayers will be answered in a miraculous fashion, though they do it in secret, though they secretly pray to God that he will send an angel. The eyes of the Lord run to and fro throughout the earth, seeking those whose hearts are happily searching for him. And so we find that Philip was this angel to Nathanael, even if Philip didn't fully realize it, in bearing these good tidings in harmony with the Manatech this morning to Nathanael. This is the work, actually, of the great company as messengers, like Jacob's ladder, who go up and down that ladder. That's what this is based on, this illusion, this picture. It's an explanation of it in part in the New Testament. Now we have another account by the same apostle. Incidentally, the apostle John is very different than the other apostles. Very sensitive. And yet here's a son of thunder. The son of thunder. And yet, a very unusual aspect of his character, he was sensitive. He was alert. He noticed things. And this is shown by his observations throughout his ministry as they have been recorded in his own gospel. In the 42nd verse. Now, Andrew first was introduced to Jesus by John the Baptist as being the Lamb of God. And, of course, Andrew wanted to do the same thing Philip did. Philip went to his friend Nathanael, so Andrew went to his brother Peter. And he, Andrew, brought him, Peter, to Jesus. And when Jesus beheld him, he said, "Thou art Simon, the son of Jonah. Thou shalt be called Cephas." Now, this did not make any special impression at that moment on Peter. For instance, Peter could have felt that Andrew had had some conversation with Jesus and said, "I'll get my brother," or something, Simon bar Jonah. And he says that he would not have this miraculous experience that Nathanael did on the first introduction to Jesus. He merely hears that Jesus address him as Simon, the son of Jonah, but he says, "Your name is going to be called Peter." Says here Cephas, which in the Aramaic is the same thing, means a stone. It was not until later, quite a bit later, not years later, but a long time later, that when Jesus ordained the 12 on the mount up in Galilee, that he called Peter. Peter first went to him, and he surnamed Simon Peter. He gave him the name of Peter at that time. This is much later, showing now Peter thinking back, reminiscing when Jesus had departed this life, had risen and ascended on high, he would, no doubt, as any one of us would, muse, reflect upon those precious moments that he had with the Savior. And this particular experience he would remember. And then he would see what Jesus really meant by those words when he had his first encounter. Incidentally, your first encounter with the most unusual person on earth certainly would be indelibly fixed in your mind. And so this unique introduction where Jesus forecast that he knew Peter and that Peter would consecrate and follow Jesus. He knew it. So much so that he could say it where Peter is not aware of the deep significance of this statement. And later, when he was not realizing it and he's following the master by foot and so forth, and then later he's given the name and it's Peter. My goodness, it's true. And I have accepted this name gladly as being one of that 12. Next, we have another unique experience recorded in the Gospel of Luke 19. the first 10 verses. Jesus entered and passed through Jericho. Now he's on the way to Jerusalem. Jericho is down near the Dead Sea level. And Jesus is approaching Jerusalem, but from about 18 miles away, roughly. And behold, there was a man named Zacchaeus, which was the chief among the publicans, and he was rich. Not just a publican. Chief among the publicans. And he was rich. And he sought to see Jesus, who he was. So he had heard about Jesus. Just like Nathanael, we believe. He heard about Jesus and would like to have a personal encounter. Not necessarily vis-a-vis, right face-to-face, but would to see who this man was, what he looked like, what his mannerism and so forth, to see if it comported possibly with his conception of what he purported to be. And he sought to see Jesus, who he was, and could not for the press. Now here's a whole crowd of people in front of Jesus. Probably were a lot behind, because actually in some accounts there are thousands that followed him. And if he's going up to Jerusalem, they could go ahead of him, because they realized going up this road, that's the only place it led to, and they would be assured that that's where he intended to go. But now this Zacchaeus couldn't get in, and it tells because he was little of stature. Isn't that interesting? He was chief among publicans, he was rich, but he was not endowed with normal stature. So he's a little man. And he ran before. Now, he wants to get away from this press, so he goes in advance, and he knows where this road leads to. So he runs ahead. Now, incidentally, he's running. Isn't this interesting? It shows humility. You know, many people are rich, so what? They can't run. My goodness, that's demeaning. It doesn't show your nobility and your stature before men. He runs before, and he climbs up into a sycamore tree to see Jesus. Now he's sitting up there in the branches, and he's got a view. The path has to go down here, and he can see when he comes by. For he was to pass that way. And when Jesus came to the place, now he's coming by this tree, what's he do? He looks up. And he looked up, and he saw him, and said unto him, Zacchaeus, make haste. I'm going to have supper at your house tonight. Now, that's miraculous. He calls him by name. Out of this multitude of people, he sees Zacchaeus, takes the time, and addresses him, probably with a very powerful voice, and says, Zacchaeus. And when he hears Zacchaeus, and he was the one that wanted to know him. Jesus first knew him. We believe that there was flashed upon Jesus' mind by the Father, not by Jesus, by the Father, who gave this impression of this tree. And so when Jesus sees the tree, that's the tree he had, and he could see this man in the branches, and he was informed his name is Zacchaeus. Incidentally, when Jesus was a man, he had to live, and he was very active as a carpenter and other things, and many of these people he talks about were living contemporaneously with him, and he would be absorbed with his own thinking and so forth. It was miraculously, but to Zacchaeus, my goodness, this was a shock like electricity through him when he would hear himself addressed personally, by name. And that Jesus said that I must abide at thy house. He's not only going to be there and probably overnight, that this is, he intended to stay there. Why, what a pleasant, joyous surprise. And what's he do? He gets down and he runs, makes haste. He made haste. It came down. You can see this little man scrambling down and received him joyfully. And when they saw it, they all murmured that he was gone to be the guest with a man that is a sinner. Now this man was a chief publican, so that he would be known by some in the crowd as to who he was. And they would be rather surprised that he would address Zacchaeus in this fashion and that he intended to stay there, knowing that this man's a publican. They don't know that Jesus knew this. What Jesus knew he was a publican. He purposely done that. And many times a miracle that's done in your personal life to another is something that's not miraculous. So the crowd, when he was going to go to Zacchaeus' home, they had not consciousness, awareness of that unique communication that Jesus had made with Zacchaeus. They would not feel that. They're dull. They're dull of comprehension. And they just see this as an incident. It's an incident, nothing specially miraculous. So Zacchaeus stood and said, now this evidently is at the place. It doesn't matter whether it was done on the occasion while he's still with Jesus or later, but notice what Zacchaeus did. I think this occurred later when he made the meal, based on another account. Zacchaeus stood and said unto the Lord, "Behold, Lord, the half of my goods I give to the poor. If I've taken anything from any man by false accusation, I'll restore him fourfold." And this is according to the law that we read some months back. And Jesus said unto him, "This day is salvation come to this house." This would be the clue as to when he said this, made these remarks, that evidently at this repast, in the presence of other publicans who would be invited as guests to this supper to see and hear this stranger from Galilee, who he was convinced was the Messiah now, that in making this testimony to them, any that would have an open and honest heart and who appreciated Zacchaeus for his position and knowing him as a man would be then keenly be attentive as to what, noticing the behavior and the doctrine that Jesus espoused. "This day is salvation come to this house, forasmuch as he also is a son of Abraham." What a wonderful consolation, because don't forget, the publicans were not considered sons of Abraham, even if they literally were. They had deflected. They had gone out of the way. He's a sinner. He's fraternizing with Gentiles. Not only fraternizing with them, helping them to collect taxes from us, the Romans. Many would despise the office of a publican. "For the Son of Man is come to seek and to save that which is lost." I am come to save the lost sheep of the house of Israel. We have one more experience recorded in John, 4th chapter, verse 5. "Then cometh he," that is Jesus, "to a city of Samaria, which is called Sychar, near the parcel of ground that Jacob gave to his son Joseph. Now Jacob's well was there, and Jesus therefore, being wearied in his journey, sat thus on the well. And it was about the sixth hour." It was noontime, as it were, the heat of the day, and the exhaustion of the trip. And particularly if coming over this mountainous road, when you've driven over it, you don't feel the fatigue. But when you go up and down these hills and all, and then in the heat of the day, probably starting at sunrise, maybe walking 6 hours, now he's sitting at the well and he's weary. And we can believe very thirsty. So he's seated. "Then cometh a woman of Samaria to draw water. Jesus saith unto her, Give me to drink. For his disciples were gone away into the city to buy meat. The woman of Samaria saith, Well, how is it that thou, being a Jew, askest drink of me, which am a woman of Samaria? For the Jews have no dealings with the Samaritans. If thou knewest the gift of God, and who it is that saith to thee, Give me to drink, thou wouldest ask of me," or of him, it says here, "thou wouldest ask of me." It's put in the other tense here, the pronoun. "And he would have given thee living water." Living water. Now she caught that expression, not just water, but living water. "The woman saith unto him, Sir," first she observes, "thou hast nothing to draw with. The well is deep. From whence that thou can obtain this what you call living water? You haven't the rope, the well's deep, and how are you going to give me living water? Are you greater than Jacob, who gave us this well and drank himself thereof, he and his children and his cattle?" Now Jesus answers her, "Whosoever drinketh of this water," that is the water that she speaketh of, shall thirst again. But whosoever drinketh of the water that I shall give him shall never thirst. But the water that I shall give him shall be in him a well of water springing up into everlasting life. In other words, once partaking of this particular living water, once it's imbibed, it becomes a spring within a person, a fountain. It's not something that you consume, it's dissipated, you take another drink, and you keep doing it until you're satisfied, and then later on you're going to have to drink again. Once taking this drink, it goes down into the belly, as he explains, I don't know if it's here or another place, and it becomes a living fountain of water, a source of delight, comfort, and help of a miraculous nature. The woman saith unto him, Sir, give me this water that I thirst not, and neither come hither to draw. You know, that's a fatiguing job, these women. They had to walk to the outskirt of the city. They had to put the rope down and the bucket and pull it up and carry it on their head back to the home. And they were doing like a man's job, and it was very fatiguing and had to be done constantly, because water is a daily necessity of life. And she would like this water for more reasons than one, that she wouldn't have to come back here again to do this, what could be an onerous chore. Now Jesus says to her, oh, and this is, go call thy husband and come hither. Well, what a leading question. And the woman answered and said, now she doesn't know that Jesus knows him. The woman answered and said, I have no husband. And Jesus said to her, thou hast well said, I have no husband. For thou hast had five husbands, and he whom thou now hast is not thy husband. This is the sixth. In that thou saidest thou truly. The woman said unto him, Sir, I perceive that thou art a prophet. Our fathers worshipped in this mountain, and ye say that in Jerusalem is the place where men ought to worship. Now, she's telling something that was troubling her, because there were these two rival ideologies. The Samaritans treasured the well of Jacob in Sychar, which is called here in this, it's Nablus and other names, depending on the period of history. And they contended, the Samaritans, that they were nearer the source, as it were, of the truth. Let us put it that way. Where the Jews contended that Jerusalem is the important city. And in her thinking, while she was a Samaritan woman, I think she had some doubts as to this contention between the two. Now, here she perceives this man's a prophet. He miraculously knows about her past. Ah, now that question can be resolved. See, so she puts the question to him. The very fact she puts it to him under this very unusual circumstance shows how much it was on her mind, the fact that it came out on this occasion. So she asks him how to answer this question. Our fathers worship in this mountain, and ye say, as a Jew, that in Jerusalem is the place where men ought to worship. And Jesus said unto her, Woman, believe me, the hour cometh when ye shall neither in this mountain nor yet at Jerusalem worship the Father. This is quite different thought at first. And ye worship, ye know not what. We know what we worship, for salvation is of the Jew. And this is true to the Jew first, then the Gentile. This is true in the Old Testament. This is true in the New Testament. The gospel was first preached to the lost sheep of the house of Israel before it went to the Samaritans and later to the Gentiles. And when Jesus was resurrected and he directed the apostles what to do, he said, begin at Jerusalem and go through the land and then go to the Samaritans and then after that go to the Gentiles, showing that the gospel was to be all-embracing, reaching all kindreds, nations, and tongues, but starting at Jerusalem. For the hour cometh, and now is, when the true worshippers shall worship the Father in spirit and in truth, for the Father seeketh such to worship him. God is a spirit. They that worship him must worship him in spirit and in truth. The woman saith unto him, I know that Messiah cometh, which is called Christ, and when he's come, he will tell us all things. Now you see, she had this thing about the Jews troubling her,
that the Messiah is to come of Judah, not of Samaria. And yet, Jacob, that honored servant who was the prince of Israel, Jacob was the father of Israel. It was his sons who were the tribes of Israel. This is what basically troubled her, so much so that theme is on her mind. And he assures her that it is of the Jew that salvation does come. And then, incidentally, in the next age, the new covenant is made with the house of Israel, not with the world of mankind. And mankind, in becoming proselytes, Jews, as it were, in the next age, by faith and obeisance, will be identified in the new covenant arrangement at that time. When he is come, he will tell us all things. And Jesus said to her, I that speaketh to thee am he. Wow, what a shock. She thought he was miraculous. He knew about her past and that he must be a prophet. And now she's seeking information. And then he identifies himself that he is that indeed that person that she is speaking about. And he's explaining to her the very thing that her faith said, that when he comes, he'll tell us all. And he said, I'm the one. And now what does she do? First, though, the others come. Upon this came his disciples, and they marveled that he talked with the woman. Yet no man dare say, like, what seekest thou? Or why talkest thou with her? The woman then left her water pot. Now, incidentally, that's how excited she was to leave your water pot. That's an important vessel. We don't realize how important that is. But to leave her water pot there and go, as she left her water and went her way into the city and said to the men, come, see a man which told me all things that ever I did. Is not this the Christ? So emphatically, so convincingly did she declare this to the men of the city that they felt that there must be some truth in this, and they went out of the city and came unto him based on her testimony. Now, we'd like to review a few things. We feel that back of all this, the Heavenly Father was the one that illumined Jesus' mind to the individuals to whom he met in life's way and these unusual experiences that have been recorded for us, and that he was the agent that the Father used. By Jesus, this call was made known to the individual that would be eventually inducted into his family. We notice certain things of the individual. Take Zacchaeus, the humility of his deportment, that he did not let the riches and the station in life that he occupied inhibit a true childlike nature. That's the thing of a child of God. The child of God may be like a Moses, as it were, but they can be meek. And usually this is not the quality. When one has riches, position, and power, it's very difficult to be humble and meek. It's almost like impossible. And yet we see that this, the poor in spirit, this class, the meek, are the ones who are to inherit the earth, the kingdom. And same with this woman, when he talks about living water, instead of saying, yeah, what, the man is a fanatic. To talk about living water that you drink and never thirst again, why, that's so unbelievable that you could turn in disgust and go away. But the ones that are humble, they weigh matters. Jesus said on another occasion, except you eat the flesh and blood of the Son of Man, you have no life in you, and then they all started to leave. Then Peter tarried, and he was questioning, but he didn't leave. And then Jesus says, well, why don't you go with the rest? And he said, to whom shall we go? See, thou only hast the words of life. So it's this counterbalancing of the counsel, of the instruction of Jesus, the wholesomeness of his doctrine, the hope that's engendered by that message, has tended to offset the critique or an analysis from a human standpoint that would rebuff the calling. It offsets it. And so we see in the ones that are called this basic quality of childlikeness and willingness to be taught if they feel that the source is a creditable one. That's important too. And they had plenty of reason to be justified in listening to Jesus' counsel. Now, another thing. When Jesus met these individuals, in some cases, it was a revealing of, like, say, Peter, of something future. Jesus predicted something future with regard to Peter. His name would be called Peter. With regard to Nathanael, it was a past act, but an immediate past. He was praying under the tree, something that had occurred before, because they had to walk. They had to come. When he found Nathanael, who was of Cana, incidentally, that was his town. Philip was of Bethsaida, but Nathanael was of Cana, another town entirely. So the coming back took time, but it showed that Jesus was aware of this earlier, that he saw this insight. So it's past, and he's coming present. He came and he dresses them, and then he tells them a future prophecy when the angels of God shall ascend and descend before the Son of Man. And so here we have two of one of the Samaritan woman, which he speaks of her past, his knowledge of her past, and he gives her instruction and information with regard to the future, that salvation is of the Jew, and that the Father seeketh such as worship him in spirit and truth. Now, at first, during the kingdom age, they will have to more or less recognize Jerusalem as the capital, as the seat and center of instruction. The word of the Lord shall go forth from Jerusalem, but it will not be always that way necessary for one to either pilgrimage there or to go there to get their questions answered. They can stay where they are as residents in their various nations, and they will be dealt with directly by another means. And it says it's by God's Spirit, and that one can communicate with God when they themselves are brought into harmony with him by the Spirit and prayer. Now, we have some illustrations of this. For instance, Nathanael was praying when this communication, rapport, was established. He prayed to God for enlightenment, and that prayer was answered. We notice that Cornelius, when he was converted, he had been praying and Peter had been praying, having dreams and so forth, and then later the word came, Peter goes to Cornelius, and then the conversion of Cornelius and his family, showing the importance of prayer in connection with communication with God. We have speculated, but we feel on a proper basis, that when our Lord instructed the two to go into Jerusalem, and that they would obtain an ass and her colt by the procedure that when they would go into the city, they would see in the way these two tethered outside a house, that it would be conspicuous as they see that village down there. When you go down in the village down there, which is Siloam, happens to be, and it's hard by Jerusalem, south part of Jerusalem. When you go there, you'll see this, and you just loose them, and you take them, bring it back to me. Now, if somebody comes and interrupts you and say, what are you doing with those animals? You say to the good men of that house, the master hath need of them. We feel that that individual had been praying to God that he would like to do something for God, and looking for providence on that behalf, never dreaming, to my understanding, that that's what would be asked of him about these two animals. He would like to do something, and then these two come and they take this out. Where are you going? And it says, the master hath need of them. That's an answer to prayer. Gladly done. And another thing we mentioned about the memorial, the place of the memorial. To have a house prepared for Passover for a large company of people, and that required a large room, and to set and prepare for all such, that's faith. And feeling that the master, I believe this person believed in Jesus as the Messiah, but he did not say to Jesus, come to my house. He just went ahead by faith and laid it all out. And then when the two were instructed, go in the city, they see a man bearing a pitcher of water, whatever house he goeth into, say to the master, the goodman of that house, that the master saith, my time is at hand. Where is the guest chamber where I will keep the Passover with my disciples? He didn't have to say, may I? This is an answer to prayer. Where I will keep this. So we find that the Father seeth in secret, that the drawing of God is something, a rapport between an individual in his providences of life, is made conscious of something superior that you cannot like put your finger on, but that you feel that you're being taking place, and that he can see in secret and deal with us in our conditions, whether they be on beds of sickness or in isolation or in great trial or in the dungeon or whatever it might be, our circumstance, that
this unseen power watcheth on behalf of those of whom he delights in. So that's the conclusion.